Basically, what we've seen in Bible study really is this. All you need to do is learn to read. But you need to know what to read. Then you need a criteria for knowing what to read. And again, I'm trying to suggest to you that this is a good criteria when you go book shopping. You will find some books that specialize. We haven't gotten to it yet. We keep trying, but you have certain books that you ought to really know that specialize on the geography. You ought to really know that Aharoni is probably the best map maker and the best in geography around. There's another little book, and part of this is recommending books to you. If you hold on for a minute, I'll get it. Well, I apologize. Like I said, I shouldn't have done this library. I got a whole, probably 100 books a couple of weeks ago, and I'm organized by books of the Bible, and it's had to shove everything forward, and where things, I could go like that, I can't do it now. I'll get it for you. There's a book called A Map Book of the Bible, and for everything in the Old Testament, beginning at Genesis, that requires a map, it's all there. It shows how Ai was ambushed by having a big arrow. This team was sent out here. Here was Ai. This team was sent in here. They attacked and backed off. And when they backed off, all the people in Ai came out of the city. And this ambush team down here came up and took the city. And when you see that diagram, there's a great deal there. And I cannot understand why some people can't do this, but some people have a hard time seeing the doctrinal significance of things. And you say, what would a map like that, what in there is spiritual? Well, to me, it is so obvious. God delivered them by using a carefully thought out plan. Does that teach anything? God is a God of order. And though He gave the victory, He didn't do it without Joshua's plan. The ambush team had to be out here. The second ambush team had to be out here. One of them had camped behind a valley, just behind a ridge. They had to be there. And all the plan was important. God gave the victory. Can you make any lesson out of that? God gives the victory. I hope you also have a plan, or God might not give the victory. And so geography, all of that can help, and help a great deal. Here is a book, and again, it's in my library, but it's hidden away because it is small, that you may want to get. Idioms in the Bible Explained by LAMSA, L-A-M-S-A. And here's the way it's put together. It's put together in Bible book order. For example, here is Genesis, and it does this way. Let me see. Now, some of these idioms I disagree with, but okay. Expression, Numbers 24:17, a star out of Jacob means a bright future for the descendants of Jacob. Numbers 33, they shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides. Your enemies will be constant grievance and worry to you, oppression and blunders. Face to face, openly, plainly, hiding nothing. Not to turn to the right hand or to the left, not to deviate, keep the law. God will send hornets, means God will send raiders, commandos, Arab bands. Fenced up to heaven in Deuteronomy 9. Well defended, fortified. To be met with bread and water means friendly and sincere welcome. Neither shall the sole of your foot have rest. Deuteronomy, I believe this is a typo, 228 verse 65. Must be 28. Neither shall the sole of your foot have rest. You shall not have any land which you can call your own. Sorrow of mind means regrets because of failure. To add drunkenness to thirst means to add evil to another. Doctrine, drop as rain. Truth from heaven, not by means of force or man's knowledge. And it goes right straight through the idioms. It is published by... this is your copy. Where did you get this? Okay, a friend gave it to you. So make friends and maybe they'll give you Lambs's Idioms of the Bible Explained. But again, you don't have to agree with this. But the attempt has been to take every idiom in the Old Testament and tell what it means. It's a good little book. Since it does deal with the text directly, it probably is not published. Okay. Now, let's go to one-room houses. After Israel had occupied Palestine for many, many years, her life shifted in two ways. First of all, they moved from nomadic life to agricultural life, and they moved, in our visuals up here, from tents into one-room dwellings. Now, first of all, when we talk about the one-room dwelling, several things need to be kept in mind. One-room dwellings. Number one, the basic idea of a house was not beauty, but retirement. The house was for retirement. It was not for beauty. It was not intended for daily living. As a matter of fact, your daily living was not conducted in one of these. This is where you go when you're finished with your work day. And therefore, in the daytime, you would not expect to find people in their house. That's not where they went. They were out in the fields. They were farming. And therefore, when it got dark and you couldn't work anymore, you needed to go someplace to retire. You needed a place where there was shelter from rain, shelter from wind, and certainly in the desert, shelter from the cold. So think of this as retirement. And that requires a shift in our thinking, because one of the important features with us is beauty. You like to have a nice looking home. And therefore we decorate it inside, we decorate it outside, we often make it very luxurious, and therefore spend a lot of time at home. Women didn't spend their day inside of this thing. They were too busy. And if you want to see the busy woman, again, look at Proverbs 31. This lady did everything. She had to just plop down in the one-room house at night and die. And so did the men. Houses were not for living in. Houses were for protection. And they were to shield you from the wind. And that is borne out by the meaning of the Hebrew word for house, which is bath. Bayith, B-A-Y-I-T-H. And the word bath has a basic meaning, shelter. It's somewhat similar to our word house, but the emphasis is on shelter from cold, from heat, from wild animals, from thieves, from muggers, from the cold of night, from the rain, from the hail, from the storm, the snow, if you were in certain parts of Israel. And the basic idea was shelter, in the sense of protection. It's interesting. A richer term, home, never developed in the Hebrew language. The only word for comes close to house or home is bath, and it basically means shelter and protection from the elements. All the sons of Palestine were homeless. All of them. Everybody in Palestine, in the way that we think of the home, they were all homeless people. And when they transitioned from the tent, which emphasized the transience of it, into the one-room house, it wasn't much different, except it wasn't transient anymore. And you can see that that house would not carry well if you're moving about. But they didn't need to anymore. Agriculture was the name of the game, not sheep. Now, with this idea of shelter and protection, and this was all of your shelter and protection, you know, and that's hard for us to identify with. Where else can you find shelter and protection from a thunderstorm? Why, you can dart into McDonald's. You could go to a shopping center. You could find a filling station. Go into a restaurant. Go into a 7-Eleven. And all of that will keep hail off your head. Since we have in the Midwest thunderstorms and hail, I've got several places right around here to take my car. So that if it looks like it's going to hail, I immediately head for the car wash and park. Or I can go to a 7-Eleven or a Vickers down here at the corners, two blocks away. And you can find shelter. You don't worry about golf-size, ball-size hail beating your head, do you? Because there are lots of places you can go. Now, they had caves, true, and they had trees. But basically, the only protection you've got from the elements and from what surrounds you is in your bath. I don't mean bath, Hebrew word, was in your shelter. Now, that is a neat concept. They had only one shelter, this thing right here, for their bodies. And in the Old Testament, one of the most common words for what God is to his people is, guess what? Bath. He's their shelter. For example, Psalm 14:6. Psalm 14:6. Verse 6, you would put to shame the counsel of the afflicted, but the Lord is his refuge. And the word refuge is our word for house. So wouldn't it be a neat doctrinal concept for God to put these people in this kind of dwelling where it's the only thing that protects you from the elements? And when you went through the front door of that place, you would be reminded of what? This is my only protection from the elements. And God is my only protection for my soul. So that while this may look like rugged culture, every time this, you swung the door, you learned doctrine. This is my human house. God is my heavenly house. And let me give you a little string of, well, let's go to a couple of them. 46:2. Here's the word. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. So notice the context of what God is. 61:3. For the Lord has been a refuge for me, a tower of strength against the enemy. 62:8-9, over and over. Men of trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. So what God was to them spiritually, he just took the name. Now, if we were going to do it in English, probably God is my home. And yet there are a lot of things with home because we entertain in our homes, and that was not part of this. You didn't give a party in a one-room house with a mud floor and water dripping through the grass roof. It wasn't an exciting place to be. It was just shelter. Get the idea? Nothing more than in that. Isn't it interesting? And let me put this out to you. I love convenience and I love comfort. And I surround myself with it. Without guilt. But we ought to say this. Every convenience that we add to the basics of food and shelter moves us just a little farther away from God. And I don't like to say that because my home is beautiful. But it is true, is it not? Every convenience we get in addition to food and shelter moves us just a little farther from God. Because the more comfortable it gets, the more we like it. And the more comfortable it gets, the more we get absorbed with it. Now, I do not mean for you to go to a legalistic extreme and decide that you will take a board and pound nails in it to sleep on so that you'll think of God. But there is truth in that. That truth even extends beyond the spiritual realm. You want to shut the country down? Pull the plug so the computers won't work. So the more man gets, the easier it is for him to slip back into the Stone Age. And I think that's such a neat concept. Man is so smart. He develops all of his systems. And he surrounds himself with all of these things that give him comfort, that give him convenience, that make him efficient, that make him fast. And able to do all of these things, and God just says, all I've got to do is turn off the electricity and you're dead in the water. You can't do anything. And if we don't think we're surrounded by it, it's been many years, but it's a good illustration. When you guys had the place down at the lake, Jane had said the electricity had gone off, if I recall the story correctly. Electricity had gone off, so we won't have heat. No problem, we'll just use the electric blanket. And hey, that's not a dumb mistake. That's what any of us could, the kind of mistake we can make. Because we're surrounded by this and we don't know how frail and fragile we really are. You talk about riding horses in battles in Revelation. Hey, that could happen. Let me tell you, it could happen. All you have to do is have a few simple foul-ups and you're dead. Not many. When Sid Newton was here when he retired from TWA, had been trained on the 767 and came back and he says, I'm coming back and this Saturday afternoon I'm going to rent a Cessna 172 and go out and fly. Because he says, all I've been all week is a computer operator. And when the computer goes, I'm sure you can tell me stories. What was it? Something about an insurance bill at a major company. Betty tried to talk to them last week. 2 days, the computer was down, and nobody knew anything about anything. Don't call us back till the computer's up. And I think you well know you could shut down business. And is it significant then that God gave his word and taught men how to depend upon him in a simple setting? He didn't speak to the technology of the 20th century. He couched his word in the simplicity of the first century, when it was a tent or a one-room house. And God's timing is always perfect. And I wouldn't want to go back to that. This doesn't appeal to me at all. But I might do better spiritually if that were the case. Okay. And I'm not apologizing for inserting little sermons in these tools for Bible study. We're here to learn the Word and make it work in our lives, and therefore I think these things are appropriate. Okay, now... If you look at the one-room house down here, the floors, again, were nothing but packed dirt. Sometimes they would mix a little lime and mud. But if you think of your floor in your house, it is a mud floor. Now, you could think of some of the implications of that. Number one would be how that floor would obviously crack. And, of course, you could fill it, but it would crack again. You can see how the woman who lost a coin in her house, how she lost it. The coin could have gone down a crack. It could have gone under a little crevice in these walls on the inside. Ours are all nice and squared off, and you can drop a coin. I could turn my back, throw a coin over my shoulder, and I could find it because our floors are smooth. There's a nice contrast between the coin and the floor, and because there's no crevice over there, it's nice, smooth, the carpet's taken up 4 or 5 inches on the wall, and losing it is no problem. You can only understand how she lost it in the light of the floors that they had. Sometimes they used bricks. Look at Job 4. And Job is alluding to some of the problems that you would have with a mud floor or clay floor. How much more those who dwell in houses of clay, and again, does that fit our culture? I couldn't tell you a house of clay anywhere, but that was common to his readers. Houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust. You can imagine how a driving rain, what it would do to a one-room house. They didn't have foundations, by the way. The foundation of this house was simply laid on dirt, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before the moth, and so forth. But they did have the clay or the brick kind of houses. Isaiah 9. Verse 8. Then it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck. And the spread of wings will fill the breadth of your land, Emmanuel. Be broken, O people, and be shattered. Give ear to all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet you be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet you be shattered. Devise a plan that will not be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for God is with us. And what does that have to do with the walls of a house? Is it 8, 9? 8, 9? Am I? Oh, I'm sorry. I was reading out of 8. Okay, I'm sorry. 9, 8. I've got 9, 8 through 10. Am I wrong? I'm saying it right, but reading it wrong. Okay, 9:8. The Lord sends a message against Jacob. It falls on Israel. All the people know it. That is, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria are asserting in pride and arrogance of heart. The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with smooth stones. Now, what that indicates is that we'll be crushed, but when we rebuild, we'll rebuild better. And one of the characteristics of a very wealthy person's home would be consistency of stones, the same size. It was still a little rugged. If you were a king, then kings and leaders dwelled in in houses of cut stone. And what that meant would be a consistent size stone, and there would be none of this jagged. They would fit together in an orderly way. That was real wealth. I mean, if you could have a house where the stones were all cut evenly and they came together neatly, you were wealthy. Most likely you were a king in those times. Now, the roof required a by Israeli building code, required a battlement around the top because of activity on it. Passage Deuteronomy 22:8. Now, here's another contrast between Israel and the church. Israel experienced God's care in a physical context. And while that is true in the church age, basically, God is not concerned about what kind of house you build. Because there was the land, and we have no land. There was the civil government that was based on divine constitution. Ours is not. And so in 22:8, you're not surprised to read something like this. When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring blood guilt on your house if anyone falls from it. So notice that civil legislation, which was present with Israel in the Old Testament. Now, a couple of things. You can take that verse in one of two ways. Number one, you can apply it literally to us today. What would you have to do, have to abandon, if you were going to build this kind of house? We all use pitched roofs. In fact, is there anyone here that doesn't live in a house with a pitched roof? Do you entertain on your roof? Obviously not. This, to them, the roof was a room. And always think of it as the roof room. And consequently, you could take it that way. What would you have to do to this verse? Okay, let me back off a minute. You come to this verse, you could apply it literally and rebuild your house. Or you could say, well, that was applicable to Israel under the law, but it's not a law for us to follow today, which I believe is the case. However, there are some people absolutely determined that you must get a shouting blessing out of every verse in the Bible. To get a shouting blessing out of verse 8, what are you going to have to do to it? You're going to have to spiritualize it. So that you come up with this. When you build a new house is equivalent to getting married. You shall make a parapet for your roof is equivalent to the rules by which your house or your marriage or your family is to be ruled. That you may not bring blood guilt on your house refers to the children if the kids fall off of it and fail to keep the rules of the house. I didn't make that up. I read it in a sermon. Now how? Isn't that pure imagination? And you always remember that you can use the Bible to express your human viewpoint imagination. And that is what is so dangerous. I remember, and if I'd mentioned his name, you would know him right away. There used to be a sermon preached by a certain well-known pastor, well-meaning and godly man, by the way, who took a passage in the Old Testament that you go from the temple eastward toward Parbar. And he said, I'm going to show you how I'll get the gospel out of that verse. And I don't even remember it, but it drew crowds. And he pulled miracles from that verse. I think Della's smiling. Did you ever hear that sermon?
No, but I heard something like it.
You heard something just like it. Okay. And what is that doing? That's using the Bible to express your own opinion. It's called eisegesis, reading in. And we want exegesis, reading out. Let it speak to us. We don't drag meaning into it. Okay, now we're almost lunchtime, but let me give you some of the unusual things that were phenomena from the grass roofs and walls. So our closing theme will be phenomena that rising from roofs and walls. Now, you can almost use your imagination. Keep in mind now that the roof has got beams. They build up so far, then lay beams across here, and then grass and straw crossways, then mud, then more grass, and the roller that keeps it down. That is your roof. And as you see, the walls are craggy. There are many places in them and indentations in them. And we're just going to look just before lunch at phenomena arising from these kind of roofs and phenomena arising from the walls. Okay? Number one, grass growing on the housetop. Phenomena of grass on the housetops. I don't think that we'll have time to get into the seasons and rainy seasons of Palestine. But after the winter rainy season, which would be probably in April, you begin to, as you approach spring, these roofs obviously are going to grow grass. Think of a concrete path that's been there a while, and if it's been there a while and it's cracked, what are you going to see? You're going to see tufts of grass. In fact, I think they even specialize somehow in growing in the cracks in your parking lot, and they're there. Now, think of the same thing. If your whole roof were mud and grass, what are you going to see after the spring rains when the warm sunshine begins to come down? Everybody in the whole neighborhood has grass on the roof. Psalm 129:6. Psalm 129:6. I want to look at three passages. Psalm 129:6. Now, God utilizes this phenomena by saying, have you guys ever seen, with all the roofs having grass on it, have you ever seen what happens after a couple of weeks? The grass all withers. And I don't know whether ours is going to do its thing for us this week or not. It may be too fresh. But this grass is green. Looks about as good as it did yesterday. I'd hoped it had died by now, but we got the grass there a little early, I guess. And very soon, it won't take long for it to wilt. So Psalm 129:6. Well, let's go to 5 to get. May all who hate Zion be put to shame and turn backward. Let them be like. What does like say to you? Cross the bridge. I'm going to use an illustration out of our own times. Like grass upon the housetops. And then notice he gives an explanation, which withers before it grows up. Isn't he saying transiency? never takes root. 2 Kings 19. 2 Kings 19. By the way, wouldn't you expect a commentary to comment on grass on the top of the roof? Wouldn't you expect it? Don't get your hopes too high.
I would think that they would every time they would see the word.
Well, you'd think so, but... Well, that's what you expect.
There you go. Thank you.
But it's a lot of work to cross these bridges. And after all, to cross a bridge and explain some historically is not a basis for giving an invitation. It's not even spiritual. But yes, it is. Yes, it is spiritual. And so the temptation of a commentary is to be devotional. Nothing wrong with devotional. But it's got to be based on facts. It can't be, S. Lewis Johnson always used to say, one of the criteria of buying good books is don't buy ooh and ah books. And what he meant by ooh and ah was that there is, when you see God's character, there is an awesome thing. But let me do my own oohing and ahing. Give me facts. And that's what you should look for. In picking up books, I'd probably go to a passage like this and flip it open and say, this guy's writing on Psalm, does he explain this? And if he didn't, I'd say, thanks, I'll keep my money and spend it where I get information. Okay? 2 Kings 19:26. Therefore their inhabitants were short of strength, they were dismayed and put to shame. They were as the vegetation of the field, and as the green herb, as grass on the housetops, is scorched before it's grown up. Get the idea? No root, no permanency, no reality. Isaiah 37:27. Kind of moving from David in the Psalms to the Kings to Isaiah the prophet, it kind of implies that the people had an understanding of what roof on the house, what the grass on the housetop meant. Unfortunately, we don't know anything about that. 37:27. And notice, apparently Isaiah is, Kings is quoting Isaiah. Therefore their inhabitants were short of strength, they were dismayed, put to shame. There was vegetation in the field as the green herb, as grass on the housetops. Housetops is scorched before it is grown up. Grass growing on the housetops. Second, leaky roof phenomena. And you can well imagine they would be prominent in this kind of house, leaking roofs. Proverbs 19. Some people think that the Bible has no humor in it. It's got lots of humor in it. Well, not lots. It has humor in it. Doesn't our God ever smile? You look at creation and animals. And God had to have a sense of humor when he made an aardvark. Or even if you look among the body of Christ, God had to have a sense of humor because of some of the people he put in it. I remember having a pastor once who was asked, why does our church attract weirdos? And his answer was classic. Light always draws bugs. Okay, 19:13. Also keep back thy servant. What am I doing here?
Foolish son.
19, 13. I'm in Psalms. That'll do it. It's that tough time of life when you got trifocals and you can't figure out which way to go on your notes. How am I going to see them? Through the middle or through this? And then you get halfway between both of them and it transposes a passage up to the next line and it's tough. What?
Beats what's next.
Yes, I know. 19:13. You are just full of it today, aren't you? A foolish son is the destruction of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a constant dripping. And you read many narratives of people that move 4 and 5 times during the night, and you can imagine it. You get a great big thunderstorm, and that roof is going to pour through water. And so you are mobile, nomadic, all day long, all night long. In fact, you got more dripping through this roof than you did over here. The tent was pretty good for holding out water. These things were just notable for that. Now, yeah. That's a possibility. That's a possibility. Yeah, it would when it becomes a pot, when it etches into the floor. Yeah. One other, and I won't ask you to turn to it, but in the book of Proverbs, there are certain proverbs that Solomon says they're worth saying again. And we always trace out, if they occur more than once, that the author is saying, worth saying again. And so, you ladies will hate me, but this thing is repeated in 27:15. Heather, you want to ask, am I really blowing lunch? Am I holding anything up? I'd like to get finished with this if I could, and I need about 5 more minutes. It's 5 after, and I don't want this hanging over, okay? I think we're having sandwiches, so I think we're okay. Okay, entry of thieves. A thief didn't kick in any doors. A thief just dug through the mud. Matthew 6:19. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in, literally break through or dig through. Are we okay, Heather? Okay. Oh, okay. Dig through and steal. And the most common means of burglary would be to work on the house. See, everybody would be out in the field during the daytime. So a thief could come in very easily. Houses were close together. Really close together. You put your house wherever you wanted. And consequently, the streets were very narrow and curvy. Therefore, you have one street, remember in the time of Acts, told to go to the street called Straight. Why did they call it the street called Straight? Because it was such an odd thing. A straight street? What are you talking? There aren't any straight streets. And so this one, you said you really ought to go see it. There's a street up there that's straight. And consequently, you'd have these streets, and consequently you could, and they would be dark, even in daytime. And a thief could easily get in behind your house and start to work on your back wall. And he could start to dig through the wall and not be seen, and continue his work the next day. They didn't go out and examine the outside of their house every day. And ADT wasn't around. So you can do whatever. Often the thieves, and we have historical records, where the thief would dig out the mud, but he didn't take out the stone. He left it if he wasn't finished. So leave the stone in there so that if they do examine the wall, they'll probably miss that I've dug out the mud that holds the stones together. And consequently, you have an allusion to that there. If you want to add another, and there are others. Job 24:6. Let's go to that. Job 24:6. By the way, there are background elements sometimes that offer various possibilities. So that, as we said with the floor, the coin could have been lost because of the darkness. It could have been lost in a crack. Or Ruth, you had one yesterday. It could have been lost in a... Okay, other possibility. So, we're not confined to one possibility. Can you think in our culture of many illustrations of an irritating dripping? Well, why would they be any different? So you always have possibilities. And all we're doing is just trying to link to, in their culture, here was a possibility for that that particular setting. Entry of thieves, okay. Job 24:6. What is wrong with me? Well, I'm sorry. There is one in Job, apparently a typo. 24:16? Yeah, there you go. Correct that. I won't do that again. 24:16. Okay. In the dark, they dig into houses. They shut themselves up by day. They did not know the light. And he's talking about the thief that digs through. One other phenomena was connected with this would be varmints. And primarily snakes would get in. Wouldn't that make you sleep well? Amos 6:19. I must have done this at 3 in the morning. What is it? 5:19, thank you. 5:19. Yeah, it's when a man flees from a lion and a bear meets him. Boy, that's an unlucky guy. He's running from a lion and meets a bear. About 12 years ago, I started doing weekends out in Stonington. And at the church there, you go up a long drive, and it's got all these trees that are really close together. And the first time I went out there, I had a dream that a bear came out of those trees, and I was running. And the problem was getting away from the bear fast enough, but also avoiding the trees. I mean, they're really close, you know, just like this. And it was a nightmare. I'm glad I can associate with this guy now. When a man flees from a lion and a bear meets him. Did Amos have to have a smile when he said that? How could he not have been smiling when he said that? That's funny. Or he goes home, leans his hand against the wall, and a snake bites him. Completely unintelligible. How many of you ever gone home, leaned your hand up against your front room wall, and got bitten by a snake? This was in my mind, and when I was in Duluth, these people had a gorgeous, gorgeous log cabin home. But I couldn't help but lay in the bedroom and look at the logs. I said, what if there's a snake could get through that thing? And I looked at places and I think the snake could have gotten through. Okay. Okay, last element here. Let's look at windows and doors. Some of the phenomena that came out of windows and doors. Heather has correctly made the window here high, which it should be, because it was for seeing out, not for seeing in. And she has taken the door and she has locked it. She has hinged it. We want to focus on the hinge of the door and on the window. First, the window. Proverbs 7:6. For at the window of my house I looked out through my lattice. The lattice would be simply the iron or woodwork, and our conception of a lattice is correct. I looked out through my lattice into the streets. I saw among the naive, I discerned continue the youths, a young man lacking sense, passing through the street near her corner, and he takes her away to her house. And he describes what he sees out the window is he looks out the window and he sees the prostitute at her station on the corner, and obviously the young man nor the prostitute saw in, did they? Doubtless he wouldn't carry on his activity if anybody was watching him. And so you have a picture of looking out through that lattice. You can see into the streets, but they can't see you. The writer tells what he observes. Proverbs 26:14. And we move from that to the hinge. Proverbs 26:14. The Bible has got some of the most brilliant metaphors, and if you only looked at it as a piece of literature, forgetting that it's the Word of God, if you look at it as a piece of literature, some of the most fantastic metaphors and writing, brilliant writing, so that as the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard on his bed. And a good metaphor is given in such a way that you can never forget it. So that with that metaphor, any time you see a hinge, you ought to be reminded, don't be a sluggard. Do I relate to the bed like the hinge relates to the door? And it's nice that we're surrounded with a world of hinges. You see, for the believer, and I close with this, everything is doctrine. Every thought that we have ought to take us back to the Word. When you see a tree and it's well rooted, where should your mind go? Back to Psalm. That's the way we ought to be planted. So that really, as it's sometimes been put, the whole world is God's doctrine book. And we ought to learn to think that way. It's hard to do it because we think of everything in terms of science, don't we? What makes the grass grow? Rain and nutrition. You go back to the Old Testament, what makes the grass grow? God. Look at the thunderstorm, and we explain it scientifically, don't we, with the discharge of electricity. And come on with all of the scientific explanation, and in the Old Testament, what is a thunderstorm? It's the voice of God. And that's the way they viewed life. Remember what we said? The more man learns, the more scientific he gets, the farther he gets from God. And it's a demonstration that man is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant fool. Father, we're thankful now for your word and for the truth it brings to us. Help us to be willing to work, to read, to dig, to understand the setting in which you placed your word. Because after all, you are an all-wise God. And you knew that people dwelled in tents. And in that context, you said, where there are tents and sheep makes a good setting for me to convey my truth and my word. And I'll convey it in that setting so men will be blessed for all time by my word if they'll dig. And therefore, may we rededicate ourselves to being good readers and obedient readers to your truth. We read to understand. We understand in order to know, and know in order to obey. May this be the course in Christ's name. Amen. Sorry, I've run 20 minutes over, and I've had long sessions this morning, but I think it's when we're most alert, so.
No, I actually know what's wrong with making a special.